I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Thanks all so much for coming. It's lovely to see so many people here to celebrate allotments and growing with us. Can everyone hear us at the back? Do wave and shout if we drop out, because I know how frustrating that can be. As Claire said, we're here to celebrate and talk about this wonderful book, The Allotment, by David Crouch and Colin Ward, for which Olivia has written a new introduction. And I didn't know this book before reading it for this event, and I was struck by, you know, its prescience and its depth of scholarship, and we'll talk about all of those things today, I hope. But perhaps what we won't stress, I mean, it's not going to be gardener's question time, I think. That's we were having a chat outside. we will try and help you with your potato blight and delphinium flowering, but some of us are more expert gardeners than others, and Olivia in particular can handle those kinds of questions. So, yes, thanks for coming. Perhaps just to kick us off then, I could ask you to establish, Ken and Olivia, your allotment bona fides. What is your relationship with the allotment as an idea before we get to, or as a place before
we
get to
talking? I'm afraid I think it is as an idea. because as we know, no ideas but in things.
Yeah.
It's really part, because it's part of Colin Ward's kind of repertoire of places where he was able to demonstrate different social relations in a modern society. And I suppose I have to say on this occasion, it's because of its kind of political purchase on my imagination that it's played this part. I mean, it's the same with plot lands, and it's the same with caravan parks, about which I've never experienced. Well, actually, I did. I lived on Canvey with my family for 2 years.
These are the places that Colin wrote about in other books. Yeah.
But it is really as this kind of place where different kinds of social relations are, negotiated.
Mm.
They're not given, but they are kind of places where people learn to live with each other.
Mm.
And it is really the kind of social role of the allotment. Yeah.
Brilliant, thanks. And Olivia, you have more practical experience of the allotment.
Yeah, my practical experience is kind of out of date. So my sort of engagement with allotments came out of coming from road protests. So I was very involved in the environmental road protest movement, living in trees, living in these, again, very ad hoc communities, sort of built in contested and peripheral places. And when I came out of that movement fairly burnt out, like many activists, I got involved in things like permaculture. I had an allotment, but I was also involved in a group called the Natty Trust, whose mission was to take over degraded spaces that were neglected and turn them into sort of community gardens. And I think the ethos was very much, it wasn't just about growing vegetables, it was about experiments with ways of living. And it was particularly about an interest in that kind of land that was somehow peripheral, somehow sort of located in a edgeland, not quite city, not quite countryside. That was part of the attraction for me, was the sort of free space. We were very keen, this is the 90s, on the concept of temporary autonomous zones. And I think there was something...
Oh, TSO, yeah.
I think there was something about the allotment that sort of epitomised the temporary autonomous zone. So yeah, it's an intellectual interest as well as a practical interest.
And it's become, I suppose, gardening is something you've been doing your whole life and is the subject of your next book. Can we announce that, or is that
top
secret?
We can announce that. Yeah.
But actually, I mean, do you see a great difference between the garden and the allotment in terms of those bigger social questions about the kind of spaces they are, both of you?
I think at its very best, the garden can be an open space that's a constant negotiation with other beings and other species. But you do have this luxury of it being private. You're in charge. You've got not total control, but a degree of control. And I think the thing that's so interesting about the allotment is you have to negotiate all the time. You have to negotiate with other plot holders. You have to negotiate with the council, which might be on board with the allotment or not on board with the allotment. So that sense of being not just in continual relationship, but the sort of sense of inventing the relationship as you go along, working out new ways. I think that's what makes it feel so exciting to me. Or sometimes really deeply frustrating. I'm sure there are a lot of holders in the room that know exactly what.
Maybe we should have a show of hands. How many of people here are actively involved in allotmenteering or have allotment?
Oh, most of you. You guys can do the talking. Yeah.
One thing I don't think I'd realised until reading this book and your introduction, Olivia, was just how far back the idea of the allotment goes, and Ward and Crouch trace it back to the levellers and the diggers and enclosures actually being the first moment when claiming land that had been common, had been public for people and allotmenting it up, you know, dividing it up to share, became a kind of live political, social and historical debate. And I wonder, Ken, how much that fed into Colin's, or rather, was the allotment always going to be interesting to Colin because of that kind of negotiation, that historical transition between public and private?
He was looking for politics in the present, in the day, in the moment. I met him in 1973, and I knew him for 40 years until his death. And when I met him, I was a rather traditional leftist who thought that a kind of political journal, you should have a masthead with a clenched fist and a big headline in block bold black letters saying, you know, Ford with the workers or general strike now. And then I met Colin, and when you look at Anarchy magazine that he edited for 20 years, it completely, to me, transformed the way of thinking about politics. And by the way, I think New Society, the magazine that a lot of people in this room would have known and loved, has to have come out of Anarchy magazine. So many of the writers in Anarchy went over to New Society, so many of the ideas. And what was different was that, and there's a very good book about the design of Anarchy magazine, because it says that, unlike most left-wing magazines, that they kind of want the brand, you know, the clenched fist and the, you know, big front page with a heavy... Every cover of every Anarchy magazine, it ran for 25 years, was different. Sometimes it was a children's drawing, sometimes it was a photograph, but you didn't know what was going to be inside. You weren't kind of seized by rhetoric at the beginning. And everything was every edition usually focused on a special theme, and it wasn't the industrial worker, really, as the social, the agent and subject of historical change, which was completely refreshing, I have to say. And as a teacher, what was most refreshing to me was that Colin did actually, in the end, put the sovereign child at the heart of political change. I mean, he was devoted to the Jean Piaget book, Moral Education of the Children, Moral Education of the Children, play and the, you know what I mean?
And so he was attracted to these kind of unofficial spaces.
Exactly.
Where,
I went through all the covers of the Anarchy magazine in the last 2 days. And here are the themes of adventure playgrounds, delinquency, the land, house and home, prison reform. Prison reform was very, very important to him. Child psychology, direct action. How do you achieve these things? Anarchist cinema, the films of Vigo, Buñuel, Flaherty. Secondary school, what is it like? How does it work? What do the children think about it? Tenant control of housing, workers' control, homosexuality and bisexuality, blues and folk music, architecture. So he was coming at politics sideways, not through the rhetoric and the books and the ideas, he was coming at it through, here are these places in our society. We're living in them, we're using them, we're working them. What can we learn from them? How to kind of spread that kind of form of...
And lots of those places on your list are these kind of overlooked or unsexy or slightly down at heel spaces that are utilitarian. And one of the images I had in mind when I was reading this is thinking about the allotment as this kind of slightly confrontational space, which is perhaps not what we think of it as, you know, habitually. But when, you know, Corbyn was mocked more for his allotmenteering than almost as much as he was for, you know, claiming Ulysses as his favourite book, there's this kind of radicalism to the fuddy-duddiness of allotments that Ward picks up on, I think.
That it embodies an old left that made New Labour incredibly uncomfortable, that they felt like they'd moved away from that. They felt like they'd swept away Clause 4, they'd swept away socialism, and with that they'd swept away the miner and the flat cap who had his allotment. And then Corbyn pops up, and that's the thing that almost embodies that radical left but sort of tatty left that feels very much not of... I'm very much of the tatty left, but it's not 21st
the
century.
Left,
the feral left, yeah. So right. I think he was signalling something with that that was really at odds with where the Labour Party had got to.
Mm. In the... Yeah, that's...
From the 90s onward.
Yeah, and the other thing this book does is, you know, it's a... For those of you who haven't read it, it's a kind of very deep, historically researched and oral history of the allotment, but it's interesting how the rise and fall of the allotment in the 20th century mirrors those kinds of political changes too. Obviously, in the sort of post-war years, the dig for victory, you know, celebration of allotmenteering made it much more common for councils to be obliged to give land over to allotmenteering. But by the 70s, and as you say, by the 80s, by the time this book was published, that had become deeply objectionable and unfashionable for mainstream politics to articulate. I wonder if you could reflect a little bit on the changing nature, the broad history of the allotment as it's described in this book and in your own experience of it. Is that too big a question?
Well, I think another person who came actually through anarchy is Richard Mabey.
Yeah.
And I think
the unofficial countryside.
The unofficial
countryside,
exactly. It's really when people take over something that's marginal and they give it such depth of meaning and purpose that it becomes almost radioactive.
Yeah.
And I think... Yeah. That's that notion of kind of community ownership and people doing things themselves is such a challenge to political orthodoxy.
Mm.
And that does draw on, as Colin would have said, the whole history of self-activity from the diggers and the levellers, from John and I were just talking beforehand. I mean, Colin was very devoted to this folklore. It's not a myth, but this folklore is found in many European and Middle Eastern countries, that if you build a house within 24 hours and you can put a chimney in and you can have smoke coming out of that chimney, that place is yours for in perpetuity. And he was very interested in this notion of the land. How do you get it back?
Yeah.
And what are the kind of the rituals? And rituals are very important, aren't they, for reclaim? I mean, even the beating the bell. You know, this is our space, you know. And footpath systems, all those things, they're always under attack, you know, because they're a reminder of the old way of claiming. And very hard struggles to claim, well, this is the way we walk to church, or this is the way we carry the coffins, or so on. And he was fascinated by that, rather than the top-down kind of looking at the land records.
Where the boundaries are officially measured.
I think that's what... I came to this book because I was invited to write the introduction. I didn't know before, and I just finished writing the book about gardens and land use. So I'd read an enormous amount about enclosure, which is the process by which land was taken from common usage or wastes, land that many people could use, into private ownership. And that process starts sort of in the 15th century, but gets more and more intense towards the 17th and 18th century, reaching something like a fifth of the land in private ownership by the 1940s, and now something like 1% of the population owns
Really?
Something like 70% of the country. Something horrific. So,
you we'll fact-check those stats.
It's in my introduction. Yeah. I can't remember the number. The other figures are right, but that one's... it might be worse than that. Yeah. Anyway, so this sort of process by which the land is being taken into private ownership, and I think I'd had a sense reading those histories, and a lot of them are really radical histories, but that was the sort of... you know, that it was a tragedy. It was a tragedy enacted upon the poor. It was a tragedy enacted upon the agricultural labourer. And somehow this book sort of twists that story on its head. It's absolutely the tragedy of the commons being taken. But what they foreground, I think, really cleverly from the sort of pig and cot schemes that start in the 17th and 18th century, is that it's a mutual aid. It's people figuring it out for themselves. It's not like... oh, the rich decide that the poor, struggling poor need to be given some land, let them have a cabbage field. It's a process by which people are demanding, insisting, and taking land and being blocked sort of in perpetuity. So now we have councils taking allotments back, but you have this sense of landowners refusing people the rights to have allotments, taking allotments away from them. So,
well, there was a lot of grumbling, wasn't there, by factory owners saying... you can't give them allotment because they'll neglect their factory work if they're growing prize-winning vegetables.
If they can grow enough food to eat, then they're not going to work for us. So let's stop them growing enough food to eat. So that sense that the point of enclosure is to create a labour force, a precariat labour force, is not a new concept. That is really the driving motivation, I think, of the enclosures. And the allotment acts as a sort of scene of resistance to that narrative. Yeah. That's what was so exciting for me about the allotment.
Yeah, I agree. That was a kind of something new for me too. But it also... sort of ties into to what Ken was saying. And in fact, one of the really kind of exciting strands for this book for me was the attention it pays to the kind of, one of the chapters called, I think, the allotment aesthetic, the look of the thing, you know, the kind of ramshackle self-DIY shed and patches that are kind of orderly but not quite orderly. Yeah. And of course, that's so opposed to exactly the kind of garden, Olivia, that I suppose English garden designers are famous for, which strip landscape of... personhood
vacated
in a very
landscape.
Artificial
the vacated landscape that has no people in it. And
the ha-ha
is the people
is
back
the,
in the landscape.
And but not in a kind of taking ownership in a kind of Protestant ownership is derived from farming it or whatever. It's about, as you say, mutually worked out and negotiated relationship.
It has this kind of radioactive power really to challenge kind of land values.
Yes.
And I mean I think like Colin, in a way, Henry George, the land tax proponent of the end of the Victorian age, was actually had more influence than Marx. And today, I think the notion that land value rather than labour value is one thing that restructuring cities as we sit here and speak.
Yeah.
It's only land values that now says what can be built where and what land has got to be used for.
Yeah.
I mean, the notion that we voluntarily might say we'd like this here and we'd like that there, it's gone. I mean, the price of land in London, for example, is just ridiculous. You can't have marginal uses.
Mm. Yeah.
And this is changing the face of the city.
And
like the railways selling off all of their land, which made a massive difference because a lot of allotments are on railway land or a lot of sort of individualist businesses were set up on railway land. And as soon as that's taken into, we're no longer letting this out on charitable basis or on low rent basis, it's got to go to the value of the land that's the adjudicated value of the land, then everything changes.
And of course, that process is just accelerating in the contemporary moment. I mean, which makes this book, I think, so prescient. Those discussions around brownfield development.
I mean, some people in the room will remember, and I can't. My memory for names is not. But just when the Olympic site was announced, there was a beautiful allotment along the River Lee. I mean, fabulous. Yeah. I went there some number of times, and they were the last to put up a struggle. And it was a completely wonderful, self-organised, extensive community. Lots of Italian people there, Romanian people there. Very... And they were swept away and just told, well, it doesn't matter, we'll put you out in Enfield. I mean, that's all the same thing, isn't it? But it isn't.
Mm.
You know, it's to do with how you feel about being next to the Lee, next to the housing where you grew up.
Yeah.
It's that piece of land.
It's the intimacy with...
And that's happening, that process is happening even within the time scales that those huge developments are pretending that they're going to accommodate allotments for. I have friends who were involved in designing a new allotment as part of the Olympic Park, which even now has been encroached on within, you know, the 10 years since the park was built by buildings that are casting, you know, shade onto the plot that now can't be sustained. So finding these scraps of land that can be protected and keeping them.
Because you're almost an invitation to the developers by taking up, oh, it looks like that's useful land. Should we segue just briefly into the project that you're doing?
Yeah, well, I would you dignify it with the word project,
but
yeah, we can talk. I run a community garden in Leighton, which isn't quite an allotment. In fact, we thought quite long and hard about what kind of vision we would have for the garden when we started it, and we settled on the idea that individual plots would be too privatized, actually. So we've got a model which is that we garden together every week. There's about 50 people involved, and it's everyone's welcome, and we plant together and we try and garden together, and whatever we harvest when it's ready is shared out with whoever's there. We're not the most productive gardeners, but we do our best. I hadn't really thought about the deep history of those kinds of negotiations until actually reading this book. And one of the things that struck me when reading it is how the kind of low level. So we've spoken about the kind of utopian principles, the mutual aid, the gift economy, all of the good things that allotments bring with them. But of course, they also bring with them the petty bureaucracies of any small-scale political organisation, however idealistic. And I wonder if that's worth talking about or thinking about how that's negotiated and what that means for these kinds of projects.
Yes.
They are utopias, of course. We can acknowledge that, whilst also say there's difficulties in those negotiations. But do you see those as part of the story, part of the beauty of the allotment is those?
Yeah, I think the utopia is also doing the utopian work of figuring out how we want to do things together, because otherwise it is just an autocracy of one person saying this is how we do this here and no conflict is allowed. My sort of experience of conflict over allotments, which actually has become increasingly sort of a site of enormous conflict in gardening generally, is that I was very interested in doing very little with my allotment. I was a herbalist at the time. I wanted to grow medicinal herbs, which are better known to most allotmenteers as weeds. So I wasn't massively popular because I was allowing pernicious weeds to grow on my site.
You were rewilding.
I was rewilding. And it's really interesting how much that's become a fault line that is just, you know, I was at Chelsea, got a flower show this year, and the debate is just racing through gardening about whether rewilding is a kind of gardening, whether it's appropriate to allow land to just do what it wants, whether the gardener should be engaged. So the allotment is a sort of social space where lots of people have got their own agenda of what they're doing on that site. Makes it, to me, absolutely fascinating. Maybe painful as a participant, but fascinating to think about. Mm.
Do you think that's one of the things that Colin was interested in?
Or well,
he had a lot of experience.
I want to write this up because I've only been thinking hard about it quite recently because I've already said it's the centenary of his death next year. Well, he was born in 1924, and so there's 100 years next year. Mm-hmm. There's quite a lot of things going on, books, films, architectural competitions and so on. So watch this space. But one of the things that he kind of would always say, but never really extended, but it was almost a lecture in which he rarely ever gave in the sense of that kind of, he said, too often we confuse the social with the political. And I made a list of the things that he would have said was kind of political, the difference. But then the social is free-ranging, inclusive, porous, self-created, episodic. Mm. It comes and goes. It's demotic. It's in ordinary language. It's playful. It's negotiated. All that is in constant negotiation. And it's usually outdoors. whereas, you know, the political tends to focus on the institutional, it's exclusive, you're either in our party or you're not in our party. It has rules of entry, hierarchy of power. Life gets very routinised. It's jargon-rich, it's goal-orientated, it's heavily dependent on the division of labour, and it's usually indoors. So, if you look at what if you look at all the books that Colin wrote about, it's the adventure playground, street life, plotlands, bungalows, beach huts, camping, public parks and public transport. Mm. So it is that tenuous kind of sinuous network of spaces in the town or the city where, you know, where kind of community is built. But it,
he thought they were worth attention, but he didn't necessarily romanticise the politics of them. No, exactly. And also it's not necessarily, I think, he's quite kind of clear-sighted and practical about the fact that this isn't going to feed the world. You know, that actually there's a... You know, the problems of productivity that perhaps some of us in this room might have experienced on our own allotments is common. And, you know, mass factory farming, professional farmers knowing, you know, using pesticides, you know, and indeed buying in, you know, fixed nitrogen fertilisers of various kinds is a more efficient use of land in terms of volume of produce made than an allotment can be. And there's a kind of clear... In the short term, yeah. So there's this clear-eyed tension, I think, or rather... assessment of that in this book, that he's not... And I guess those kinds of arguments are underpinning, Olivia, what you're talking about too, the tension between rewilding and formal gardening and what effects turning every back garden in the country into a wildlife haven would have on the environmental kind of questions that we're all facing, which are lurking in this book, but aren't as acute, obviously, as I think they are today for us.
I think it would have been really interesting to see what Colin would have made of the next... Was it written in the 80s, this book?
88, it was published.
Yeah, of the next 20 years, in terms of... You feel the sort of nascent ecological questions being asked, but the sense of... Yeah, exactly those things. Nitrogen fertilisers, the idea that you can farm in those sort of ways is becoming more and more of an impossible argument because of what's happening to soil health, what's happening to microbial activity in the soil. So... I wonder whether the allotment would actually start emerging now as a potentially more useful answer to those questions.
I would push for the community garden.
The community garden.
Only because partly I was thinking, you know, do you remember, you know, G.K. Chesterton is mentioned in this book and his kind of quite wacky theory of distributionism, which someone summarised as he thought that owning the means of production meant everyone had to have a coal mine in their back garden. There's that kind of sense of the hyper-localisation of production. But of course, he also, Ward and Crouch both point out that the kind of utopianism of you know, they talk very critically about collectivization in Soviet Russia and the fact that the allotment became this symbol of freedom after, during the Cold War and afterwards. There was this explosion in allotmenteering in Russia and also in America in the 40s and 50s. I was astounded to hear that it was the biggest hobby in America, community gardening.
And in East Germany, where they occupy a really interesting position because they were these individualistic spaces. So in a culture that is incredibly sort of directed, controlled and surveilled, the allotment and the allotment shed suddenly becomes this politically very subversive and, you know, a kind of sanctuary space in a way that we might talk about in sentimental terms, but in that particular political moment, in those decades, it's something much more meaningful and powerful.
It's as significant as a pair of Levi's or something in terms of self-expression.
Well, almost more so, but as high risk as a pair of Levi's.
Yeah.
Which is hard to think about when it's sort of got this kind of cosy aura in England that it might have been a place that was really dissident.
Yeah. There's a couple of... Sorry, Ken, did you want to...
I was just going to say that, obviously, it was a paradox that he earned... Well, he, for a large part of his life, he actually worked in the Town and Country Planning Association, which is... You don't normally put anarchism and planning, you know, in the same sentence.
But maybe you should.
But he was very interested in architecture. But obviously, he was interested in architecture that didn't... kind of wasn't intentionally brutal or designed for the long-term future. Provisionality was quite his thing, so which is what you get in the Japanese kind of culture, the provisionality of all buildings, because things might change.
He's wildly ahead of his time.
Yes, and I did promise I'd say one Colin Ward joke to
You said you'd give us the best. Yeah. Yes.
Well, then the joke was that he did a lot of work on prison reform, and he reviewed a book once by an American architect who designed lots of prisons, and so he interviewed him and he said, "Well, tell me a lot about these prisons because they're very ambitious." He said, "Well, the main theme of the brief is." It's going to cost a lot of money, but it's got to look cheap. and it's this notion of intentionally building in degradation into the design.
Yeah.
And that's why provisionality really was his kind of...
In a kind of not planned obsolescence,
stick.
but allowing things to end when
they didn't work anymore, and you can make something new. The sense that you can be eternally creative and respond to your circumstance, presumably.
Yeah, and obviously there are lots of buildings that are very successfully repurposed in London, and there are lots the ones that are actually now going up that will be very difficult to repurpose. So it's that thing, yeah.
Yeah.
We've spoken about, I suppose, one of the parts of this book that feels prescient but isn't emphasised perhaps as much as we would nowadays, which is the kind of ecological dimension. And in the final few minutes of my questions, I wanted to ask about another couple of kind of the allotment now, I guess, and where this book is pointing towards. One of the things that the book describes is the changing demographics of allotmenteering. And in the post-war years, as we said, there was this big boom, but it was still a fairly masculine working class endeavour, according to the oral histories that Crouch and Ward collect here. But they're already describing in that moment, in the sort of 70s, back to the land movement and the good life kind of model of reconnecting with the earth that was around and about then. The fact that, you know, people who were perhaps more interested in medicinal plants than growing kind of prize-winning leeks were moving on to the allotments. And there's an element of kind of tension there sometimes between those different user groups. But I wonder if we could reflect on how that development has continued, especially in the last few years with COVID.
So much. I think COVID played such a huge role in people's desire to get back into growing. And actually, it's interesting, the statistics for access to gardens in the UK are unusually high. We have a large sort of allotment of gardens in this country.
Do you mean allotment?
No, I mean literal private gardens, balcony gardens.
Right,
yeah. But the access is, unsurprisingly, completely skewed along both class terms and race terms. So the allotment, I think, still occupies that same role, that there are people who really need allotments who don't have access to land, people who don't need it because they have already access to land. So I think it remains as political a space as ever, but there was something about the pandemic and the desire. This happens in every plague situation, war situation, is that interest in gardening just rockets up. So seed suppliers find that they're at highest ever sales. And this happened, interestingly, in every country. So India, Italy, America, Russia, us all experienced the same huge interest and practical interest, buying of tools, buying of seeds. So basically, I think the need for allotments is, if anything, more powerful now than it's been since the Second World War.
And also the fact that lots of people don't want to go back to the office. And so that four-day weeks, yeah, the timetable of life is changing for a lot of people. And some people retiring early now can't see the point of it, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I love the story you told at the end of your introduction about your friend who gradually retreated from working life into the P-Rose, just lying there listening to the bees buzz.
Naked, it was a kind in the P-Rose, in this sort of Edenic tent of red flowers, not going to work at all.
I would prefer not to. I just like. But of course, while this renewed interest in the allotment that we can all celebrate, and indeed gardening and open spaces and growing things, has exploded, the availability of allotments has plummeted. I mean, the stats in this book were already pretty bleak by the late 80s, and they've, as you say, Olivia, in your introduction, just got worse since. I think there's 100 people per 60 acres. No, I can't remember the stats now. The stats there. So, well, we'll look it up. It's really bad. It's really bad.
You have to
find the stats. And for the reasons Ken's articulated, that's increasingly pressurised, certainly in an urban context, by the need for housing, which is, you know, a kind of balancing act. So maybe my final question would be, what's the future? Is there any hope for the allotment as a living space as well as an idea? And what can we do to kind of celebrate, preserve?
Well, I think it's got to be linked back to housing policy and community land trusts. I mean, we've got to rethink the kind of configuration of land and housing and people's relationship to it. And you can't do that with land values as they are at the moment. So you've got to defray the cost. You know, can't pay market prices for land in London and achieve social housing that works and is meaningful.
Yeah.
And that's either a political challenge for the Labour Party or whatever government is going, or they're just going to avoid it and just say, well, you know, that's the market.
Yeah.
And the market will therefore dictate where the poor live, where the rich live. I mean, there are whole areas of London now where the housing is very expensive, but it's unoccupied. It's just bought for, you know, as a bank vault. Yeah.
Yeah.
So the land value thing is, you know, bring back Henry George.
Yeah. And that it's, you know, people need houses, but at the same time, it's ecologically catastrophic to just turn land into housing or offices, as is continually happening in London. So that sense of making housing projects that always have some sort of community garden as well as individual gardens. And it, I mean, the thing that's so exciting about allotments is it sort of admits to the tension between the desire to do something together and the desire to have control of your own creativity. So I think the reason I love the allotment is that it allows you to do both. It's not just absolutely individualist, me against the world, but it's also not sort of relentlessly, uniformly a collective endeavour. It rubs constantly up against both, and it's constantly having to be reinvented situationally. So it remains this sort of very exciting utopian space.
Yeah, I love that image. And of course, that's what's so beautiful about the allotment as well, this kind of fairly standardised, almost like each plot being a canvas or a moment of expression that standardises the... It's an emergent thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like, look at the cover of the book. I mean, that kind of particularly... Yeah. I think it is particularly kind of British as well as a vision of what... I mean, there's a lot of debate in the book about the difference between the vision of socialised allotment-type spaces in continental Europe, which are often kind of holiday home, you know, the chalet model, the leisure garden model, as opposed to the productive allotment of British culture. I would say, practically, for anyone who's interested in starting something like a community garden, just do it. Like, we've got away with a lot just by digging up tarmac and putting trees in, and not ask for permission after it's been done. But perhaps I can talk more about that if anyone wants to afterwards. I think we've been talking now for 45 minutes, so I'd love to hear from any of you if there are questions, either gardening questions or political questions or questions about anarchist carrots or whatever. We'd love to hear from you. So are there any questions? Does anyone? Someone here at the front, yeah.
I think there's a mic coming.
There is a mic, sorry, yeah, but you can shout and I can...
In the book, there's mention of, as you touched on, the fact that gardening and allotments are the biggest leisure industry, if you want to use that term, in this country. So why the hell don't we have some sort of support, as sport does, as other things do? And it was recognised as probably one of the most healthy leisure industries that you could have. And one of probably the cheapest to run, if you could get people, councils, to donate space. It's ridiculous.
I think that's a really good question, because I think that there is some strange historical division between the garden and the allotment, which means that bodies like, say, the Royal Horticultural Society, which is supposed to represent all of us as gardeners, are not really on the side of the allotment, and maybe regard the allotment as a space of vegetable growing and then not really in their purview. So I think that's true. And the sort of garden renaissance that's happened over the last 3 years, the argument has been made over and over again about how much gardening as an industry brings to the country, but somehow it leans on the private garden and doesn't think about the communal garden, even though clearly it has health benefits and it has profound ecological benefits. I mean, you were saying earlier about the local council supporting you because of the flood management, getting rid of the tarmac and putting in plants. You can make an argument for that.
One thing that does come across strongly from the book that I didn't know a great deal about at all is this tension between kind of the utopian, you know, the Thorpe Report, which was a very kind of important document in the establishment of, or the promotion of allotments in the 20th century, which advised that councils should be obliged to provide a certain amount of land per population for allotments, and various other really quite important and utopian ideals about what the allotment could be as a movement just seem to be completely ignored or brushed aside by councils because of, the, I suppose, the reasons that Ken describes about...
And austerity politics, and which we haven't used that phrase at all, but I mean, it is the gutting of councils over the last, 10, 12 years.
But we haven't talked about, where does the allotment fit in the family of public parks?
Right, yeah.
Because, I mean, there's quite a lot very good work being done recently on use of parks. They're the most popular in leisure activity. But allotments kind of seem almost utilitarian, whereas they kind of don't fit in. And I think they should be embodied within the parks kind of family. So that that kind of philosophy of green space.
And it's actually tendered by...
Yeah. I mean, when you think of a public park, it's, you know, like Clissold Park or London Fields. I mean, London Fields has, on a busy Sunday summer, 20,000 people there. Mm. No security guards. Mm. Now, in any other public place, you only got to have 300 people and the council... Yeah. Police will demand, you know, 10 private security guards.
Yeah.
So that there's this whole kind of self-policing kind of world. And I think, you know, we need a much stronger philosophy of the public, of the green public space. Mm. And the allotment really should belong with the park system.
Maybe all of which can be understood as the commons.
Exactly, yeah.
Maybe they fear the organised nature of allotment owners and allotment...
Sorry, could I just interject again? I think part of the problem is that the allotment space is a closed space and therefore the problem with...
Literally padlocked.
...access to more than just the members.
Yeah.
And that is going to be a contest that I think we have to...
And I think it's not about adjudicating for one versus the other. It's about having both. But I do think that that's part of it. That they do, and I think that's part of probably a lot of people's emotional sense for allotments is if you have one, wonderful. But if you don't, then it's this sort of utopia with literally a chain and a padlock almost always.
Mm. Well, it's another reason why I think we felt quite strongly that we would establish a community garden rather than allotments, because although we do have a padlock, everyone's welcome when we're open to come and participate in the garden. It's not like you need to be a key holder to get in.
Yeah. So.
During the war, last war, a lot of parks were dug up as allotments.
Yeah.
And Crystal Park has growing communities in the middle, which has took over a redundant kind of...
There's an amazing nursery project in Nottingham that is a friend of ours who has a community garden and has planters all along one edge of which are just for public foraging, essentially. So anyone who's passing can harvest whatever's ready at the time. And we want to do the same, but our gates are in front of the road. So anyway,
so there's
not quite possible.
There's a project related to that, which is called Edible Estates, which works both in America and I think they had one here by the Tate. Hmm. But the idea is that anyone contributes to it, but the food is there for anybody to pick as they're walking past. You don't have to have actually laboured on the garden in order to go and pick a pear. And there's something very beautiful about that, because that really is a free space.
Yeah. I mean, there's that amazing project in Detroit when all the motor... And they just took over the buildings and started using it. Irrespective of who they got.
Thank you.
More questions? Further questions?
I wonder, could you say a bit about who David Crouch is and what his involvement was in producing the book with Colin Ward?
David Crouch was a landscape historian.
Yep.
Did you know him?
He's still
He is still a landscape historian. I think he's just retired recently.
And he's done the two lovely drawings in the front. And I think he obviously cooperated with Colin on the book.
But you don't know about the methodological... approach they took, because there's a lot of oral history, there's a lot of kind of interviews and site visits in this book, and I would have loved to have been
fly on the wall when they cooperated together, because Colin was not, I mean, was very kind of the demotic language, you know, the everyday language of everything. But no, it worked well. I mean, it's an important, but then Colin cooperated with Dennis Hardy on two books on the plotlands, holiday camps. So Colin
was
also
a collaborative
great,
writer.
Yeah, he was a very, very collaborative writer.
But David Crouch has written a new introduction to this book as well, so you do get a sense of his sort of up-to-date thinking about it.
Yeah.
And he was also involved in a TV programme that I haven't seen, but he was tied in with the book.
The Plot,
which sounds very... the kind of thing that should be uploaded to YouTube somewhere.
I bet maybe it's we on can YouTube. Do it, but, yeah. You can watch it.
Thank you.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Any other questions? Is anyone? Yeah.
Would you mind if I held forth a bit? Rather than asking a question.
More of a comment than a question.
I'm pro-comment.
Well, it's really in response to something you said, Olivia. Is this working, by the way?
Yes.
Okay. About trying to make sure that this sort of gardening, not just allotment garden, community gardening and so on, was open to all classes and ethnic minorities and so on, which I entirely agree with. But I will say that my experience in a London primary school, where I was working with the children who were new to English and with their parents, and also running the gardening club, gradually led me to realise that there are a lot of people from ethnic minorities, women I'm talking about, we didn't really get the men in that much, for whom gardening is really undesirable. It sort of like, it reminds perhaps of a time when in a different country you were working on the land. And there's nothing romantic about working on the land if you've been forced to. And similarly, with a lot of our working class parents, the very last thing they wanted to do was get their hands dirty. So, I mean, I think although one wants to be, come one, come all, one and all don't all necessarily want to come.
Though that isn't the history of the allotment. The history of the allotment is very much that it's a working class space. Well, no, the history of the allotment is absolutely 100% that it's a working class space. That is its history. As in, no, I'm not talking about right now. I'm talking about where the allotment emerges from is a desire to create an antidote to the enclosure. So they're developed by mutual aid societies. They're developed by miners. That's where the whole notion of the allotment in Britain comes from. So where it's at right now in terms of communities that you live in, I can't comment on. But in terms of the allotment social space in our culture, that is what it is. It never existed as a middle-class idea, though I think it's probably been co-opted by middle-class people. But I think that they're so emphatic in this book about really tracing its history and not saying it's an idea by middle-class people as a sort of, you know, noble... I've forgotten the word.
The phrase they use is the gentrification of leisure, which is one of the kind of forces that is happening in the 80s. I mean, I think we can all agree that no one should be compelled to work on an allotment.
When
we started our community garden, my in-laws, who are Yugoslavian, were appalled that we wanted to spend our time grubbing around in the dirt. They'd left kind of impoverished farming life behind. But I don't think that, you know, that says anything about what allotments can give you if you're interested in taking them on or working them. I mean, there should be spaces that you can...
And I think, wasn't there a big scheme called Learning Through Landscapes, which was to do with the recultivate, the tearing up of the asphalt of all traditional playgrounds to turn them into much more growing areas? And I think very successful. So I think there are kind of steps towards reimagining, you know, the use, the high status you know, the importance.
You have to have access before you can decide whether or not you want to...
What you want to do. But also there's something, I don't know, this is a sort of nascent thought, but there's something about the allotment as purposeful, utilitarian gardening, as you get something from it, you get vegetables, versus the flower gardening that's just aesthetic. So I don't know, that I wonder how much... There's a desire to make a kind of decorative garden rather than having to grow carrots, that allowing people to choose what they want to grow and how they want to grow, or that they want to do nothing in a garden, they just want to sit in a garden. That all of those possibilities, I think, should be available in the community garden.
I mean, that's my vision. I want that. I want to sit under the beans in my pants. There was a hand up over here, and then one back there, and then one over there. Hopefully we'll have time for... All three.
Hi. Just sort of partly in comment on participation. I mean, I think from my own understanding of how gardening and gardening projects, whether community, allotment-based or home gardening, for large communities, people with mental health or challenging issues that they're confronting, whether that's to do with personal lives, their political or economic circumstances, that both in answer to, kind of comment about why we aren't getting a kind of national organisation that represents gardens, is that it's split often between things like health as well, because increasingly health and the health benefits and mental health and well-being are associated with gardening in all locations. And that isn't, that's come out of COVID, it's been very obvious, and social prescribing. But also the issue of accessibility and perceived access, I think, is greater than actual access, because I'm sure in your community garden and from all the research on community gardens in the States in particular, is that the perception of whether you can have access is much, much greater. And it applies to the landscape in general for minority groups, for different ethnic groups, that how they see these things as being available or of interest is a very different thing. But it's access to these things, I think, has to be kind of factored into. How does it seem attractive? Now, I know, and lots of small projects are ways into this. So projects that I'm aware of, in Lincolnshire, for example, a small project on community horticultural therapies, it's just finding spaces that you can let people just wander onto in a place that they would come to anyway for another reason. Mm. And so it's being able to find those spaces and negotiate with the owners of those spaces or the leaseholders of those spaces to get that across. So you can create an allotment or a quasi-allotment space that is accessible. Sorry, that's a bit of a diatribe.
No, that's really a good point. And I think it's something personally that we've had to learn by kind of doing, in a sense. The perceived access that you speak about is so important, especially when, ways of communicating what it is that you're offering to people, clear signage, just being welcoming, not being on Instagram, but flyering when you're having an event, things like that, I think have had a massive impact on the kinds of people who are using our space.
But I mean, I don't think any of us want to force people into going to work on an allotment.
I do. I don't.
But, it's a bit like the adventure playground. People say, well, it's dangerous, it's dirty, children today won't. But, adventure playgrounds are successful. City farms, the dirty, the animals are going to produce viruses and bugs. But if you don't have these spaces in a city, what have you got left? Asphalt and glass.
And things to buy.
Yeah, and things to buy and supermarkets. But, these small places, they don't have to be everywhere, but they kind of act as a reminder that there are other ways of thinking about space and being in the world on a daily basis, under the skies, in the rain or whatever, and playing differently.
And therefore thinking differently.
Yeah, we don't want allotments, we don't want to tear down Bloomsbury and make them. But we want to
fit a few in.
But we do want kind of spaces of imagination everywhere.
There was a question, just in front of you. You still have one, and then I...
I just really an observation, or a couple of observations, really. The first is that I've been benefiting, I think, from working on an allotment where we have a plot rep who really doesn't really care that much about what goes on. We have a lot of different ethnic groups, all sorts, we're sort of fairly inner city part of London. And what has happened is people have developed their plots the way that reflects their social circumstances. So gradually, some people with families, they've enlarged their accommodation, shall we say, their sheds. So that's great, because their kids come along and they can sit in the when it's raining in there, and they do. So it's a really interesting sort of development, I think, that is one thing that hasn't really come out. It's just how the space is being developed. But against that, you've got this real problem, and it was touched on earlier, that, of course, only a limited number of us have these allotments. And we've got a situation now where the pressure on land is enormous, which reflects the value, as you've said. And personally, now we're getting to a situation where you can see the council are putting pressure on, oh, we want this land for development. And you're thinking, well, how do you fight? Do you fight this? Is it right to fight this? Because you're depriving someone of homes. Mm. And it troubles me. And
what's the feeling amongst the allotmenteers?
Well, like, because, there's the number of political conversations you have on an overall plot of maybe about 50 plots. Probably talked to about three or four plot holders who are, if you like, politically active, you know. I mean, you know, there are asylum seekers, there are refugees, there's all sorts, you know, and you can't get on that level with a lot of plot holders. Mm. Other people just don't care, of course. And that, you know, that it's interesting, though, and it does trouble me, and I'm interested in any thoughts that you would have on that.
I think we sort of touched on this before, but I think setting housing against the values that the allotment stands for is somehow fundamentally wrong, that we need both. It shouldn't be an either or. It shouldn't be you have to relinquish this land that you're using for, you know, sustainable growing, but also for biodiversity, for community, because you need housing. We should have both. We should have a possibility of having both. And it's so often that two necessary things are set into conflict because something else is happening in the sidelines, and something else is the kind of commercial building that, particularly in London, is going on all the time. So, you know, I don't know what the answer to that is in terms of your own particular plot or the kind of conversations you can have on it. But I think feeling that you've taken something from other people's potential homes is wrong. That's a sleight of hand that people who are profiting from the increased land prices would be very happy for you to be thinking.
Well, I think it goes back to what Ken was saying about this being as much an architectural question as a gardening question. You know, it's about
how we want to live. It's a question about value, isn't it? Yeah. At its centre is how do we value our lives? What do we want our lives to involve?
Yeah.
And what part does profit play in our lives?
Yeah.
And also, if you look at the design, a lot of town extensions and so they start with the road system, and the road is everywhere.
Yeah.
And there's no grass.
Yeah.
Or, you know.
And they don't have a doctor's surgery, and they don't have a school.
No.
But it is very noticeable and pernicious how the garden, the community garden, the amount of I mentioned earlier, a group in the Olympic Park, and there's been a couple of. We got a load of donations of plants from a community garden that was there temporarily while the developers decided how big a building they were going to build on the plot. And they were given this space for a few years temporarily. But the sense in which the allotment or the community garden or the green space within a massively developed part of the city is always a potential building is pernicious. And it's not, I think Olivia's right, I agree. It's putting that anxiety onto gardeners, onto those who are using those spaces generatively and generously is kind of appalling and a failure of policy as much as it is. So don't beat yourself up, I would say. I hope we've got time for one more question because there was a hand up over here and there's a mic if you want to, just so the people over here can hear.
My comment was really just to follow on from a previous comment about, kind of maybe people coming from other parts of the world and coming here and not feeling like they wanted to get their hands dirty. I actually feel like that's not my experience in terms of the people I've met. And I made a film a few years ago called Our Land, which featured four black farmers in the UK, and three of which, you know, the allotment was very central in terms of them being able to access land for a start and also kind of reconnect to where they came from. One of the farmers is a Windrush generation and he kind of learned how to farm from his grandfather in Jamaica. And, you know, having access to a farm is still impossible for him, but he's managed to cultivate chocho and various exotic fruits and veg from Jamaica in his kind of plot, in his allotment. So he's been able to be kind of enterprising and and also, you know, reconnect to the land that he came from. And the same with another farmer who's from Zimbabwe, and his family had a small allotment in Tottenham, and, you know, that's what ignited his love for food growing. And he's now an urban farmer, but a lot of his contemporaries, well, all of his contemporaries basically thought that he was crazy to be going to work in an allotment and to be a farmer. But I think, you know, those spaces are really helpful for people to be able to connect to a land in a meaningful way, you know, when they are far from home, and that was their kind of norm where they came from, but, you know, is not really possible in the UK. So that was just a kind of comment to make.
Yeah, thanks for that comment. And that's definitely, I think, reflected, as well as Olivia was saying, the history of the allotment in this book, is it's always been a site of cultural exchange and of people who want to grow whatever it is that they want to grow. There's a really great organisation called Land in Our Names, Lion, which is doing a lot of work to try and increase access for... Oh, really? Cool. Yeah. And of course, their argument, which is, I think, you know, completely legitimate, is that you can't say people aren't interested in gardening until they have access to spaces in which they're able to garden freely. And
the gardening is always, on some level, I think, engaged with making yourself feel at home on the earth. So the choice of growing vegetables that are from one country that you lived in to another country that you're currently living in, those sort of things, they're really emotional transactions, but they're also really political transactions.
Great. Well, we can carry on the conversation over drinks, I think. But thanks so much for coming and for all your questions, and lots to think about. But I hope this has given us a sense that interest in allotments and allotments themselves are in rude health. And go forth, and I wish you a good harvest.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.